welcome to this NDTV special coming to you from the Jaipur Literature Festival. At a time when there are concerns that the global economy may once again be headed for a slowdown, and there are also concerns over whether Achhe Din are here or still elusive for the economy at home. On this program, we bring you an unusual platform of extremely eminent voices, perhaps covering the left to the right of the ideological spectrum when it comes to economics. An extremely eminent panel indeed to talk about whether inequality is rising, whether India may yet see reforms, whether reforms are indeed the way ahead, whether wealth creation is necessarily good for growth, and much more. Let me introduce our guest today, starting with Choma Piketty, of course, the author of the seminal work, Capital, Arvind Subramanian, the Chief Economic Advisor, and Vivek Debroy, well-known economist, author, and someone who now is with the Niti Aayog. Welcome all. Let me start with you, Arvind, to give us a perspective of where you see the Indian economy standing today. And I ask you this because in your own mid-year economic review, you actually had to retrace from your original growth projection. You now say it'll be between 7 to 7.5%. How worried are you with what's happening in China, with the fact that we're not seeing private sector investment, you know, sentiment really showing positive signs? How concerned are you about the India growth story right now?
Right. Firstly, I just want to, you know, clarify that it's true that, you know, I revised down the forecast. But remember that there were two really big exogenous factors that forced us to change the forecast. One was that, you know, global markets were considerably down relative to when we first forecast that. And we calculated that about at least 1 to 1.3 percentage points of growth was shaved off by the decline in world markets.
Yeah.
And second, of course, agriculture didn't do as well as we'd expected. But apart from that, I think the forecast was broadly in line with what we'd said. So that's the first point. The second is that, you know, at this stage when, you know, the world economy seems to be in some amount of turmoil, I think all of us should be worried. I think we should be worried because, you know, China is such a big part of the world economy. It represents a big market. But also, you know, the manner in which anything could happen could spread deflation to the world. So, you know, all of us are going to be affected. But that being said, I think that first, you know, we need to do what we need to do domestically. That's the best defense. Second, I think we are much better cushioned than, you know, most countries in the world. Our macroeconomic, you know, vulnerability is very good compared to the others. And we're still amongst the highest growing economies in the world. So I think in that sense, we are cushioned. But then, you know, when these headwinds come, they affect all economies and everyone has to be concerned.
But you've actually argued in favor of deferring fiscal consolidation and saying that maybe we have to postpone that process. And it is time for the government to begin spending. Is the government paying heed to that?
Well, I mean, these are all decisions that I think, you know, we will take in the course of the next few months.
But why do you think it's important for the government to spend at this point?
Well, I mean, if world demand is down, you know, and we want to maintain the growth engine, then we have to find domestic sources of demand. And the way I like to put it is, I mean, it's a question that we raised that at a time when global demand is down, when private investment is weak for some historical reasons, should we enact aggressive consolidation at this time? And I'd love to hear Thomas Piketty's views on this, because essentially, Thomas, the question is that should we, under these circumstances, go for aggressive consolidation or not? Because, you know, we had promised earlier to reduce the deficit by about 0.5 percentage points of GDP. I mean, consolidation. And Barkha, the thing is that I think that we have to remember that the question is sometimes posed as, should we relax, should we increase the deficits or, you know, or not? That's not the choice. The choice we're raising is, should we aggressively consolidate or not aggressively?
Which may lead to increasing the deficit. And you've actually argued to us that given the gaps and given the inequities in India, this is not the time to focus only on containing the deficit. So how do you see the India story?
Well, first, we should never aggressively consolidate. We should always do it smoothly. But let me put it in a more sort of long-run perspective. You know, I think India needs to cope with inequality. You know, I think if India wants to become a developed country, and I think India has the potential with the energy, the democratic institution, to become, you know, the main or one of the main or maybe the main economic power and political power in this century. But for this, you know, the Indian elites have to understand that the level of inequality that we have in this country, in particular the lack of proper public investment in basic health services, basic education services, basic infrastructure, is just not sufficient, and that's not gonna make it. You know, if you the total health budget, public health budget for a country like India right now is around 1% of GDP. So I'm not saying you should become Sweden with 10% of GDP, but you know, China is has 3% of GDP. So there's no way you can do the same with three times less money. You know, you can do all the reform you want to make the delivery process more efficient, and of course that's important as well. But if you have three times less money, so you're not going to make it. So you know, one of the lessons from my book, and you know,
and
by
the
way,
I see the Hindi
translation. I'm very proud that an Hindi version just came out today. But you know, one of the main historical lessons from this work is that in the West, it took major shocks, major political shocks in the 20th century for the elites to finally accept the kind of social and fiscal reform and that can deliver broad-based investment and equitable growth and sustainable development, which India has not faced yet. And so I think, you know, there is a short-run decision of how much you finance by tax, how much you finance
and
by
public deficit. And you, of course, think the rich should be taxed more.
I think in the long run, you know, you need to finance the extra public spending by tax. So, you know, deficit is not going to be the way that India will go from, the tax GDP ratio right now in India is 10%. You know, I think it should be 20%. I think in the next 10 years, it can go up gradually by 1 percentage point of GDP per year and go from 10 to 20. When you have a 6% or 7% growth per year, you know, it's possible to put an additional point of GDP each year into the building state capability and the possibility to invest in equitable growth.
So, you know, what you're saying presents an interesting conversation, Vivek, for us as Indians, because we hear a lot of aspirational India. And we say that we're finally in India where wealth creation is not a bad word, that there was a time when the socialist instinct of India used to look at wealth as a bad word, that we actually celebrated povertarianism. But you actually have Thomas now directly challenging that narrative and actually saying inequality is rising because Indian elites aren't actually willing to contribute their share to the growth of the country. How do you see this essential contradiction between the right and the left?
I don't think it's a contradiction between the right and the left. I think there's a great danger in sweeping generalizations without understanding the context, the data, and the nature and the constitutional nature of India. Take this figure, 10% tax GDP ratio. Yeah. Is that correct? It's not. That 10% is only union government taxes. The moment I add state government taxes, not even local body taxes, the figure is around 18% of GDP. So it's not 10. About 3.5% is because of exemptions.
Right.
You take away the exemptions, not 3.5, even more. 5% is because of exemptions. You take away the exemptions, then it becomes more than 20%, it becomes 23%. So the argument is one of removing the tax exemptions on the personal income side, on the corporate side. It's not a problem with the corporate tax rate. The problem is with the effective corporate tax rate. So the agenda is not whether the tax GDP ratio is 10% or not of GDP. The agenda is a tax exemption removal agenda, which the government is trying to pursue, at least on the corporate side, is due to happen soon. Let's take this issue of inequality.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, we do not have data on income distributions on a regular basis. We have data on distributions of consumption expenditure. One of the aggregate measures of inequality is the Gini coefficient, which also hides several things because it's an aggregate measure. What's the consumption inequality as per the Gini coefficient? It's about 3.32, 3.33, 3.34. Rural India, it's about 3.2. Urban India, it's about 3.5. Even if I accept the argument that inequality in the distribution of income is going to be higher, what would be the inequality in the distribution of income as per the Gini coefficient? It would be 0.42, 0.43, something like that. That is not something to be alarmed about yet. But the more important question is not what is the inequality, but what do you do about it? And the fundamental reason for the inequality is, as Thomas himself said, there are 100,000 villages where you still don't have all kinds of public goods and services. So that's the agenda. The agenda is not this red herring of what is the Gini coefficient.
Do you want to quickly come in on that, and then I'll take it to Arvind?
Right, but to finance this investment, you need, you know, the proper tax revenue, and you need more transparency. You know, I think the Indian elite has to face the fact that right now, you know, we don't really know, we don't even know how many taxpayers each year, you know, have between 10 and 20
You've
million.
You've been complaining
rupees,
about this gap in the data, you know, for a long time.
I think, you know, this has to change. We have to understand why this has happened for so long. You know, we need to understand why in a country that has passed a Right to Information Act 10 years ago, we've had 15 years without proper income tax statistics. So maybe this is going to change today, it will be time, but in any case, you know, we want to understand how did we get there, you know, why is it that there is so little transparency. There are other countries in the world, like China, who don't publish income tax statistics, but first, you know, this, I'm not sure this is an example to follow, and next, what's unique about India is that there used to be all India income tax
statistics
that were removed, and that's very unique to my knowledge in history. Now, the source of growth in India has to be, you know, better investment in education, health in the bottom parts of the country. There's no doubt about this. Let me just say one thing. I think, you know, we underestimate inequality in India by a lot when we look at household survey. You know, I think inequality is gravely under-measured in household survey, which are based only on self-reported information. And in every country in the world where I have been able to use other source of data, more reliable source of data, you know, even in countries where the income tax system is not working very well and there's a lot of tax evasion, you still get a much higher level of inequality with the administrative tax data than with the household survey. So I think the view that we have about the Gini coefficient in India, which is supposed to be an sort of intermediate inequality level country, is far too optimistic about where India
So let's first pick up what you said about no access to reliable data, income tax data in particular. Arvind, I heard you right now on stage saying that by the next time Thomas is here, that data will be available. But how did it go missing? Why is it missing?
No. These things happen in the past, way before my time, so I have no clue why it happened. But I think that, you know, we will do our best to, you know, kind of make this more, because I think it's important to understand the problem. And I think that's a fair point that we will try. And I think, you know, this government is committed to that. But I want to come back to the points that, you know, Thomas and Vivek raised. You know, I think that if my you know, small, you know, disagreement with Thomas is that I think the relationship between growth and inequality, and I think everyone would agree, you know, goes both ways. I think that you know, Thomas is a very strong proponent of the view that, you know, if you, you know, attack inequality, you will get more. It's good for politics, it's good for economics as well, and I think that's a fair point. But I think equally, I think we know that if growth increases, that's going to have a first-order effect on poverty reduction.
But his argument is that wealth creation doesn't necessarily lead to...
No. I think the evidence in India is that, you know...
greater equality.
No, I think in the period that we...
We want to have both. You know, I think we don't want to choose between growth and equality. We need both.
So it's a two-way relationship. That's why I don't think you say one or the other. But I think in terms of policy choices, what Vivek was saying is exactly right. I think that, you know, what is it that we need to... And I think we're all in agreement on that. You know, we need much more, you know, public investment in all the services, you know, whether it's health, education, power, you know, roads, law and order, you know, so it's a kind of public investment agenda that we
but
can
we
all...
But we have seen some cuts, in fact, in social sector spending, given the argument that a lot of the revenue of the states has increased and now the states can spend from their available resources. Vivek?
No, this, again, my problem is that much of the debate is completely misinformed. Take health.
Yes.
First, I'm not disagreeing with his figures, but the figure he gave is public expenditure. If you include private expenditure also, the expenditure on health is probably about 4 to 4.5% of GDP. But let's not get into that.
But there are problems with the private expenditure on health.
Let's not get into that.
Because you say it inflates the GDP as a percentage.
Let me just finish what I was saying. Take health.
Yes.
Where is health in the Constitution? It is in the 7th schedule, bang in the state list. It's not even on the concurrent list. So why do I look at the union government's expenditure on health and say health expenditure has been slashed? If I want to make that argument, let me look at the state government's budgetary expenditure also. And I repeat, half the people who talk about this do not realize that health is not even in the concurrent.
So are you saying,
it's squarely in the
are you saying it's the responsibility of the states?
It is, as per the constitution, until you change the constitution.
And that is, in a sense, when you increase the revenues of the states or the tax collections and you shared more with the states, you were reminding the states that it's your job to spend. But doesn't Tomas have a point, and we can disagree on this, that when Vivek also computes the private health spending, that's not quite the same as what a state owes its citizens on health?
So I think that, remember, I think Vivek's point becomes even more important in the context of the 14th Finance Commission recommendations, where we allocated more of the resources to the states. So in that sense, you know, given the constitution and given the fact that we've devolved more resources, I think the point is that more and more of the responsibility of this has naturally to go to the states. That being said, I think that in the economic survey or in the mid-year analysis, we showed that, you know, in the first half of this year, the quality of expenditure, both at the national level and combined national and center, has been improving. You know, the expenditure on health is rising, the expenditure on public investment is rising as well. So,
but do you agree with Vivek that the primary responsibility is not of the union government and of the states on health, on health?
Yeah, constitutionally that is the case. I think what we don't realize is that there is a real tension here that I think we all should understand, which is that, you see, the Constitution tells us, you know, whose authority it is.
Yeah.
I think, you know, even for people on the left, I think they struggle with this tension, right? Different people say different things are very important, and each has his own list of what's very important, right? So that's a value that people have. But equally, we have a value that these decisions should be made as close to the people as possible, because that's how delivery becomes more efficient and accountable. So we struggle with this tension. I think the Constitution, as Vivek says, that it gives that to the states, but perhaps the center can do more by way of, you know, saying what's important, what's not important. But that's the kind of
ongoing... Let me just put something to you, and then Tomas can come in. You know, Raghuram Rajan, speaking at Davos, told us that he believes corporate debt is a huge problem. And when corporates, and you know, some of the top 10 Indian corporates are in debt, when they, and I'm quoting him, when they flaunt yachts and have lavish parties, the messaging is all wrong. And when you juxtapose that with the argument that corporate tax has actually been reduced, it would speak to Tomas's narrative that corporates are getting an easier ride while the state is cutting down on social sector spending. I know you disagree. I'm just saying the narrative then.
No, you join the statement is not correct.
Which one?
The statement is not correct.
Which
the
one?
Corporate tax rate is not going to be reduced. The effective tax rate for corporates will actually go up. Don't focus on the 30 to 25.
Okay.
Focus on the effective corporate tax rate.
And exemptions are being
But what do you think about this flaunting of wealth? Flaunting of wealth from corporates who are in debt. This is the RBI governor speaking.
Yeah, but that's a private thing. It's not something that I can, you know, if private people are flaunting their wealth, you know, I as a, you know, public civil servant,
private people who owe banks money.
Yeah.
Are flaunting their wealth. Not private people who don't owe anybody money are flaunting their wealth.
No, I think that to the extent that we have this problem of, you know, the whole debt resolution, I think it needs to be done in a way that we apportion the cost of those mistakes and those decisions fairly between all those people who contributed to it. And that's why we need, you know...
So explain that.
No, so for example, the whole, you know, the PPP projects that, you know, of the past that have been, you know, the whole stalled projects phenomenon. I think it's come about because of a variety of factors, right? There was over-exuberance. In some cases, the external environment changed. In some cases, bad decisions were made by bankers. So I think that it's, and of course, equity holders also made bad decisions for which they must be responsible. But I think that we need a process, and that's what the government is doing by unstalling these projects. We need a process for the bankruptcy procedure is another example of that. You know, we need a procedure and institutions for fairly apportioning the cost of those, you know, mistakes, and then move on.
So you don't agree with making a value judgment, either of you, on corporates who are spending money while owing money?
No, but there's an important point that I want to make in this connection. You see, this issue arises because the assets and liabilities of an enterprise can be delinked from those of the individual, which is the entire limited liability concept.
Yes.
The reason the bankruptcy law is important is that's only true of the corporate sector. For MSME, the small and medium enterprises, even today, the assets and liabilities of the enterprise are not delinked from those of the individual. So the signaling part, I'm not reacting to the signaling part.
But neither of you are speaking directly on what Raghuram Rajan has said.
No.
Do you agree? Do you disagree?
No, no. Look, I cannot comment on behalf of Raghuram.
Not on behalf, on your behalf, on your own behalf.
I think wealth creation is good for society, wealth creation is good for everyone, and you've made tons of money, you go flaunt it. It's none of my business.
Right, but if you owe the banks money, should you flaunt it? I think that's what
he's contesting. No, but that is why I brought in limited liability. That's the reason I brought in limited
liability. Okay, Arvind, quickly, and then I want to go to
I have no views on the flaunting. I think the point is that...
Even if they owe money?
No. But we have to address the owing money problem, not the flaunting. Flaunting is, I agree with Vivek, the owing money, we need how to... You know, we need institutions like the new bankruptcy law and other mechanisms for, you know, fairly apportioning the costs of decisions made in the past between all stakeholders, and in a way that will allow us to address the problem, but also move on in terms of, you know, increasing private.
So you're
investment.
Saying how people spend their money is their own business, even if they're in debt. Yes,
as a private matter. This is a private matter. I have no.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to enter into this controversy, but I think it's fair to say that the financial system is sometimes biased towards the big players in a way that is not acceptable. And I think I don't know much about the Indian case, but I think this is certainly true in India in a number of situations. Regarding corporate taxation, let me say that the argument that you can always reduce the statutory tax rate, but that the effective tax rate will increase, so there's no problem. You know, we have to be careful with this argument, because this argument is always made by people who want to cut statutory tax rate. And above a certain point, you can see that if you really cut the statutory tax rate to very low level, that's not going to do much good to your tax revenue. So let me just say that, in Europe, there are countries which now have gone below 10% of corporate tax rate.
We're nowhere there.
You go to 25, and then in 5 years, you will say, I want to go to 20, and then to 15. I know this trend. I've seen it. And in the end, at the end of the day, you end up in a situation where the large corporations in particular end up paying, very limited tax on their profits in the country, and less than what the small and medium-sized companies, and less than the, middle class and bottom class are paying. So we want to be sure about the statement you make about effective tax rate. We cannot take it as granted. The other point I wanted to make about the controversy about the state versus union spending, I think... If you I'm not going to get into the controversy, the constitutional controversy for India, but if you put all public health spending together, both from the union government and the state government, you get to about 1% of GDP, all together. I'm sorry, these are the best estimates we have, 1.2%.
We don't have a figure, that's the problem.
Well, the best estimate I've seen by Drez, Sen, other researchers, are that you are somewhere between 1.3% of GDP. Even if we are not sure about, the exact, 1.5, we are sure about one thing, is that, in China, you have 3 to 3.5%.
And we are not anywhere near that.
Even if the data is not perfect. Now, the other thing we are sure of is that when we compare life expectancy, with countries of similar per capita GDP, you compare to Vietnam, you compare, countries which don't have huge per capita GDP as compared to India, they live 10 years longer. There is a problem with the public health system in this country, and I think denying this would be wrong. There needs to be more money. Now, is this a grant from the union government to the state government so that they can spend at the more local level? Is it, this I don't know. But in any case, there's clearly a problem of how much resources you put into this.
Vivek, briefly, and then
Now, if it's health, I cannot react briefly.
Okay.
The point is the following. Health outcomes in India are not as good as they should be. Agreed.
Yes.
Is it a public expenditure problem alone? No, I don't think it is. It may be a public expenditure problem, it's much more a public delivery problem. And the issue is that sitting in Delhi, we have been arguing that here is a centralized template which, regardless of which part of India, I'm going to superimpose. So Kerala uses PHCs, primary health centers. Every state in the country must use PHCs. That need not be the case. A state like Tamil Nadu or a state like Gujarat might say that I will never be able to get the physical infrastructure of the primary health center in place, and even if I do that, I will not get the doctors, I will not get the paramedics. Mm-hmm. So instead, let me adopt a model, I'm simplifying of course, where my issue is to ensure that the patient is gets basic treatment there and then is referred so to the district hospital. So I fix the transport problem. Now this is the issue. So far as how much of health, how much of public expenditure is on health, I do not think we know the figure until 16, 17 or 17, 18 for the very simple reason that all the states are in the process of restructuring their schemes on the basis of the 14th Finance Commission. That's when we should have the debate, but it's not a public expenditure debate.
So I think that, you know, I think the people on the left, one of the things I think they kind of ignore is the following. You know, as Bibek and Tomas have said, you know, I think our outcomes, clearly we need to improve, whether it's learning outcomes, health outcomes, no question about that. Complicated questions, is it resources, delivery, etc., all this. But I think one thing we forget, and let me give this example of education in India, that we've known that historically our public delivery of education has not been as good as it should be, historically as well. Yeah. But in fact, once we got the growth going, you know, since the mid-80s or early 80s and so on, what that did was, you know, the supply of education, public supply, was not the best. Mm. But once we had rapidly growth, the demand for education increased very rapidly. Mm. So that was an impact of how growth itself created an improvement in educational outcomes. And so I'm saying that it's two ways. It's not just, you know, you have to...
Fair enough. You've spoken of education. So let me give you a recent example of how the state may fail its citizens, but that can impact their political rights. And I'm talking about decisions in Haryana and Rajasthan to actually disenfranchise or I would say stop people at the panchayat level from contesting elections if they don't have a minimum educational cutoff. Right? Now, it could be argued, Arvind, and I know this can be argued both ways, but it could be argued that it is the state's duty to deliver education to all. And if the state fails in that role, should people be penalized in exercising their political rights for something that the state failed to do? How do either of you see what's happening in Haryana and Rajasthan?
Haryana and Rajasthan would take us off on a tangent. But isn't it connected to the inequality debate? I would phrase it in the following fashion. There is a big difference between saying that the state must provide education or health and saying the state must finance education and health. There is a very important difference between the two. Mm. For people who are poor, the state indeed needs to subsidize and finance. That does not mean that the state has to physically provide and run the schools and the primary health centers, because had that been the case, so many decades after independence, we would not have been sitting here and debating this issue. The history of the six odd decades after independence has been this public provisioning driven model, which has not worked.
Well, this has not worked in India, but you know, this is what has worked in the rest of the world. So I think at some point it's important, you know, to look at you know, what works, what doesn't work, and you know, I don't know if you compare private health provision and public health provision in the world, you know, what I can tell you is that, you know, compare US and Europe, you know, you have private health provision in the US, it costs a lot more, and in terms of outcome, health outcomes, you know, life expectancy, anything, it's just not working. And, you know, I think anybody looking at the health systems that are working or not working, you know, will come to this same conclusion. So, I think it's important here to escape from ideology and try to see, you know, where is it that public provision can work? And, you know, I think in health and education, again, if you put three times less money than countries at comparable development levels, this cannot work. One point I wanted to make about the example you gave about political rights and political discrimination is that, you know, it's a... India has, of course, you know, very complicated legacy with extreme inequality of status between you know, different social groups, and has tried in a way more than some other countries to develop a positive discrimination system, affirmative action system, reservations in order to try to face this legacy. But I think there's a new challenge today to face, which is to try to see how this system can gradually evolve from a mostly caste-based discrimination system to a system based more on parental income, parental wealth, and here
bringing income into the reservation model.
And this is where the issue of transparency and lack of transparency is much more than just the lack of income tax statistics. You know, I think many people believe that it's quite strange that there was a census in 2011,
socioeconomic
census, and we still don't have access to the data and the information. And I think the whole point of the census was to try to clarify the very complex and multidimensional relationship between economic inequality,
That's
social inequality.
That's a good point.
Inequality.
That bring in an income element, but how do we bring it there if we don't even know what's in that survey of 2011?
Let me just say one thing. I think we have to correct the record here. I mean, in the field of, I'm not saying that we're perfect in terms of transparency. In the field of development economics, the country on which the most research is done is India, because by and large we have the most accessible information, we're the most
and
open
this
research.
Is the biggest country
that's true, but I think on the other point that Thomas makes about this whole public private provision and saying in the West we had public provision, I think it's a really hard question that I think Western economists take a state capacity as given and just believe that you can kind of improve it at the drop of a hat, and this is where his delivery point comes in. So the question is that what happens if in our situation, for various historical reasons, our state capacity is limited, then the choices of financing versus provision actually and what the state should do, where it should focus its energies on, become very important. And that's, I think, the spirit of what Bibek is saying. So I don't know enough about these areas to say, oh my God, it should be private, or oh my God, it should all be public like in the West. But I think state capacity is a very, very scarce good in India. And how best to deploy that is something that I think we need to think much more deeply about.
It's not just state capacity, it's state resources also. Because implicitly in all of this is a prioritization of resources. Just sort of back of the envelope. A lot of people argue expenditure on health should be increased, education should be increased. Education, public expenditure should be 6% of GDP, standard argument. Health should be 4% of GDP, 10%. Infrastructure should be 10% of GDP. That's already 20% of GDP. Let's say a tax GDP ratio of 20%. Are we arguing, therefore, that the government should do absolutely nothing else? No defense, nothing? The point I'm flagging is, before saying on ABC expenditure should be this, you also need to say where that money is going to come from. Very clearly, the money is not, it's not just capacity which is not infinite, resources are also not infinite.
So what would your, you would say the state should not spend on education?
I did not say that.
That it should provide access to education that other people could pay for.
I said that there is a question of prioritization of
resources.
So
what would you prioritize?
I would, for instance, argue that the entire issue of subsidies on which we spent close to 14% of GDP on subsidies, which are in the name of the poor, explicit as well as implicit. It's not just explicit. These are not subsidies that the poor get. But in the name of the poor, over the last six odd decades, we have had these subsidies which benefit urban, pampered beneficiaries like the three of us. Well, Thomas is not a beneficiary directly. So we need to target that. That's the debate.
Thomas, do you want to come in there? And then these last comments from
Yeah, building state capacity is, of course, a gradual process. I'm certainly not saying that India is going to become Sweden next year. So this has to be a gradual process. Yeah. But a gradual process doesn't mean that we, a flat process where we do nothing. We have to go in this direction. So I think, again, when you have a 6-7% growth rate, the experience in the West is that this is the time where gradually, year after year, you can put an additional 1% of GDP into the state capacity, certainly not more. You want most of the growth to remain in the private sector, but you want to increase state capacity right at this time. And at the same time, you want to build more trust into the tax system, more transparency. I should also say again about transparency, because I didn't quite hear Arvin's answer about the census and the lack of access, the fact that 5 years after the census, it's still impossible to see the data and to be able to use it. In order to build trust in government and to build trust in public spending and public taxation, it's not enough to have a theoretical right to information act. You know, it's important to, if you take this big example, census, income tax, you know, to be very concrete.
Firstly, I completely endorse the idea that the tax, income tax data should be available.
Yeah.
But I also want to say that do not assume that that's going to tell us a great deal about income inequality for the very simple reason we have only 35 odd million income tax.
But what about the caste survey of 2011?
Wait.
We don't even know that.
Wait, yeah. Please get the figures right. The number of income tax SSEs is 35 odd million, right? And this is this is taxable income. It is not income. As long as the base is not broad, yes, the data should be available. But it's not going to tell us a great deal about income inequality.
I mean, on his question on the survey of 2011 and why we don't go public with that.
Well, I don't deal with this very closely, but we did have to, you know, have the results validated by each of the states, and that's taken some time.
2011. I don't know whether this was the Vijay Kelkar Finance Commission thing, in which case it was commissioned by the Finance Commission.
No, this is a socio-economic.
Socio-economic census of 2011.
But that rural sector is public.
Yeah.
It's already public.
No, it's a very limited part of the variables that are public that were asked in the survey. No, the full files are absolutely not public,
not even
a sample.
No, look, so far as the urban part, if you make the argument, is true. So far as the SECC is concerned, right down to the village level, I won't get his individual data because that's a privacy issue.
Oh, but you can have a sample, anonymized sample.
Yes, so that data is all there.
No.
Of course, except the caste part, which is being...
The caste part is what he started by.
The caste part.
Yes, because he said a reservation policy, if you want to put income in it, can't be framed without knowing the caste
service. So specifically caste. Now, the caste issue is very simple. On caste, because the OBC definition varies from one state to another, you need to reconcile that. That's the reason.
And there's a committee.
Okay, I need to get quick last questions because I know time is up. Okay.
This was done 5 years ago. So
which one?
Well, the census. So at some point, does it have to take
caste, as he just said, there is a committee under Arvind Panagaria which is reconciling it. So except for the caste, don't say nothing is available.
Okay, now,
say only the caste part is not available.
The main subject of the census.
Arvind, we can't let you go without asking you contemporary concerns here. You know, on one hand, you have, Tomas arguing inheritance tax, wealth tax. On the other hand, we're struggling for a single tax system with the GST. Do you believe that with your standard rate that you've recommended in your committee, 17 to 18%, do you believe that the Congress is right in saying put that into the Constitution? A. B. Have you more or less given up on the goods and service tax coming by the April first deadline?
No, I think that, you know, putting any tax rate, in the maximum tax rate in the Constitution is a completely, I would say it's an outrageous kind of recommendation. No country puts, you know, tax rates in its constitution for very, very good reasons. Things can change. You know, maybe we want to, you know, want to tax some commodities more than the standard rate, etc. On the second, I think the government has not given up hope on this. And, you know, we're hoping very much that, you know, we would still see the GST see the light of day. Very much so.
And the value of the rupee against the dollar? Quick comment on that as we end.
No, these are determined by market forces, and you know we have the RBI in charge of that. And you know, I'm not going to comment on the level of the rupee.
So what are
wealth tax, inheritance tax? Any comment?
Are there any more questions?
Inheritance tax. Take that, because he's been arguing that a lot.
I am against that.
You're against that?
If I tax income properly, that's the increment. I don't think we should be taxed.
So why should you pay more tax when you make 1 million rupees with your income than when you receive 1 million rupees from your parents? You know, I think when you receive money from your
because
parents without
parents
working,
because my parents have paid the income tax.
Right, but look,
you should have another debate on this.
Yeah, look,
have paid on that.
Right, but you know, maybe this was 50 years ago. Maybe
doesn't
this
matter.
Was, maybe this was
I only
parents.
Tax income.
Okay, so when you make money on your own, you pay more than when you receive it. You know, maybe there was no income tax when they made the money 100 years ago, 50 years ago.
When the Income Tax Act in India has been there since 1961.
Now, look, you should pay less tax with the money you make
by
yourself.
Well, this one we will disagree.
Okay,
will not
what does the Chief
agree.
Economic Advisor think on inheritance tax, very quickly?
Is 0% enough?
I've not thought about this. You know, I've just written a report on the GST and I feel more comfortable answering.
On GST, Chidambaram writes saying Arvind agrees with two of the three Congress demands.
I mean, the committee clearly said, gave the RNR, which was low. We did not agree on the fact of it being in the constitution. And what was the third point? The third point was
judicial.
That was not in our remit in any case. So we didn't get into that.
And the sin tax, as it's being called, for colas.
You have
the cola companies in a tizzy.
As we said, we did not change any of the structure of taxes. They were what they are currently, because these are political decisions that will be made by the GST Council going forward.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Tomas Piketty, Arvind Subramanian, Vivek Debroy, pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.